go on to the middle chapter. And this one is called Mendel and the Gene Idea. Mendel being Gregor Mendel, who hopefully is famous enough for you to have heard of him. Do you know about Gregor Mendel? Well, he is dead. He lived in the 1800s, and his work wasn't appreciated during his lifetime, but after he died, it was discovered, and now he's known as the father of genetics. He figured a lot out about how genetics works without having any idea what a gene is without having any idea what DNA is. So it's pretty impressive work. He was a monk in Europe, and specifically he's this one right here. I think what he's holding here is a flower of a pea plant. He worked with pea plants, which we'll be talking about in a minute. He was unusual as a biologist because at that time in science history, biology was not really too much of an experimental science. It was mostly a descriptive science or observational science. Most biologists were naturalists, which were people who would go out into nature wherever they lived and carefully document all the living things, all the plants, animals, and so on. So they discovered things. They didn't really test things with experimentation. And even those that were experimental did not really have an appreciation for the power of statistics. And to get good statistical data that you can actually get information from requires doing the same thing in your experiment many times. You don't just test on one plant or one subject. You won't be able to figure out your results. With the statistics will be meaningless. Well, he had an appreciation, Mendel did, of having to do replicates many times. He did hundreds and thousands of replicates in his 8 experiments that we'll take a look at. Otherwise, he would not have been able to figure out what he did. It's remarkable what he figured out anyway, but he had no chance without doing it a lot of times. Anyway, that's the man, and he figured out inheritance patterns, why they work the way they are, and when inheritance works under a certain set of conditions, which I'll give you in a little bit, we call that, in his honor, Mendelian genetics, which is what the first part of this chapter is going to be about. Things don't always happen that way, though, so there's also some non-Mendelian genetics, a set of conditions that lead to non-Mendelian genetics that we'll also look at in this chapter. First, though, with Mendelian genetics, let's look at slide 2, which shows you the basic technique he had to use. He worked with pea plants, and he was very meticulous, which was why he was successful. He had to put a lot of time into this. Not a lot of time every day. I mean, not just a lot of time every day, but he had to work for many years to do this. He had to work carefully for a long time just to prepare, just to be able to come to the point of being able to start the experiments, which involved working with pea plants. And pea plants, not all plants are like this, but pea plants are examples of plants in which the flowers, which are reproductive structures on flowering plants, contain both male and female parts. Male parts are called stamens. Those are the slender things that have a little bulbous ending called an anther, which is where pollen is produced. Pollen contains sperm. So it's the male producing organ, the male gamete producing organs. Carpels are female gamete-producing organs. They produce eggs. The ovary is this bulbous part of the overall carpel. The carpel is this bowling pin looking thing. And for successful fertilization in a flowering plant, a pollen grain containing sperm has to land on the sticky end of the carpel and then start digging a tunnel all the way through the length into the ovary where it can meet up with an egg, creating a new zygote. That's how plants, that's the plant version of fertilization. And this usually happens more or less randomly, either by wind blowing pollen, or by animals of some sort, like bees or mostly insects, but also some mammals like bats. Anyway, Mendel needed scientifically, experimentally, to take all the randomness out as much as possible. In other words, he had to make sure that he was in charge of which plants were reproducing with which other plants, which were the parents, in other words. And he therefore had to carefully go to flowers and snip off the male stamens so that that pollen would not be able to pollinate the same flower's carpel. And then in a different batch of flowers, which he was growing in a separate section, he would then have to carefully take a brush, collect pollen from the ones he was considering to be the fathers, basically, and then brushing that onto the ones that he was choosing as the mothers. He was determining the crosses, the reproductive crosses. And assuming that all went right, after some waiting, of course, it's not instantaneous. You have to wait for the fruit to emerge, which the fruit is the children. A pea pod containing some number of peas is really a bunch of siblings. Each of these peas is genetically different from each other, just like brothers and sisters are. But they're not adult pea plants, right? So he can't tell what his results are yet either. He has to plant those then wait till the next year, when they grow up to be their own plants, and make his measurements on those. So this P generation is the parental generation. That's what he starts with. The offspring, the first offspring of those are then called the F1s. The F1 generation stands for first filial. Filial just means of offspring. And thankfully, he had enough insight to realize that he should do this again then. So he would cross an F1 with another F1 to produce the F2, not shown here, which takes another season to get any results for. So let's go to slide 3 and look at just one of his 8 experiments. Now, he did 8 separate experiments, which involved keeping plots of land separate from each other so they wouldn't interfere with each other. In each of the 8 experiments, he paid attention to just one thing. That's what really made the experiments different from each other, what he was paying attention to. And so this brings up, before we look at this first experiment in detail, brings up some important definitions. Now, in everyday language, the words characteristic and trait are used more or less interchangeably, right? They mean pretty much the same thing outside of biology. But in biology, in genetics, they have distinct meanings, which is important. A characteristic can be just about anything that's observable about an individual. And observable does not necessarily mean something that you can visibly detect. We're humans are visually oriented animals, so we tend to think about vision a lot. But it could be, observable means anything that you can basically measure, like it could be the speed of an enzyme, for instance. It doesn't have to be something that we can see visually. But anyway, flower color, which we're looking at here, is an example of a characteristic. But, and just in a human example, let's just say hair color, that's a characteristic. Well, you already know, though, that there's not just one hair color, right? There are multiple hair colors. The individual possible values of that characteristic are what traits are. In other words, black hair is a trait of the characteristic hair color. Blonde hair is another trait of that same characteristic. Yeah, the example?
No, both.
Well, the individual values that a characteristic can take on are what traits are. Okay? Do you see the difference between characteristic and trait? Any given characteristic can have some number of traits possible for it. Well, in the 8 experiments that Mendel conducted, what makes them different from each other experimentally, because they all used the same exact technique of cutting it with scissors and using the brush. That's how he did the crosses. But what was different about the 8 experiments is that in each of the 8, he paid attention to only one characteristic and ignored everything else about the plants. So in this particular one of the 8 that we're looking at here, the only thing he cared about was flower color. He didn't care how tall the plants were or anything else, just the flower color. All right. Also true of all 8 is that for whatever characteristic he was interested in, there were only 2 possibilities. There were only 2 traits. Which is not always true in nature, right? Sometimes there's more than 2 possible traits for the characteristic, like hair color. There's more than 2 hair colors. But for all of his 8, there were only 2 possibilities. And I'll say a little bit more about the requirements of Mendelian genetics in a bit. But let's go to this first example. This is flower color. That's the characteristic. And the 2 possible traits are purple flowers and white flowers. Part of the preparation that took a long time before he could even start the experiments I was talking about earlier is that he had to make sure he was dealing with true breeding purple flowered individuals and true breeding white flowered individuals. A true breeding individual is one that when you breed it with another true breeder, you'll only ever get offspring that are just like that. And that takes some additional years working with the plants before you're sure of that. All right, but what we have here is a purple-flowered parent crossed with a white-flowered parent. That's the P generation. So he did the brushing and cutting and waiting and planting the peas and then waiting until they grew up. That's the F1 generation. And what he saw, and he did this about 1,000 times in this experiment, is that every one of the F1 generation, 100% of them, were purple flowered. There were 0 white flowered individuals. And not only that, which is interesting in itself, no white flowers, the purple flowers of the F1 generation were fully purple. They were just as purple as the purple parent. And that's pretty interesting when you think about it, because for thousands of years, humans have realized that in sexual species, whether it's humans, plants, or whatever, the offspring seem to be kind of a blending of the traits of the 2 parents, right? So knowing that, you would kind of predict that when you cross a purple-flowered individual with a white-flowered individual, you should get a purplish-white-flowered offspring, somewhere in between purple and white. That didn't happen at all, though. Thankfully, Mendel wasn't satisfied with that interesting result. He said, what happens if we now cross these with each other? So, for the next year, he did the same technique of crossing an F1 with another F1. In other words, brothers and sisters would be mated, or not mated, crossed, to produce more seeds which are planted, and then you have the F2 generation the following year. And in the F2 generation, notice that you have white again, white-flowered individuals again, which itself is surprising because they came from parents, both of which were purple. But not only did you have white again, you had purple and white, but you had almost exactly 3 purples to every white. In other words, there's a 3-to-1 ratio of purple to white, which he would not have known if he had just used 1 or 2 plants. But look at his real numbers, 705 purples, 224 whites. If you use a big sample size, you get meaningful results. And the more you do, the closer and closer the ratio will be to exactly 3-1. So these two traits got named dominant and recessive. Purple is the dominant one here, and white is the recessive. Now, the dominant trait is the one that seems to dominate over the other, which is why in this cross, purple dominated over white so that all the F1 offspring were purple. Recessive, as a word, is the adjective of recede, which means to pull back, hide out. Right? And that's what it seems like white is doing. It's receding here. You don't see it. But then it comes back out in the next generation. Now, speaking of dominance, not only in his experiments is one of the two traits dominant over the other, but the dominance is complete. We say it's complete dominance. And so this now brings up what I said I would tell you about again, as far as the requirements for inheritance to be happening in a Mendelian fashion. In other words, the requirements for Mendelian genetics. Two major requirements. One is that whatever characteristic you are studying, there has to be exactly two traits in the population, not more than two. It's possible for there to be more than two, but in that case, you don't have Mendelian inheritance, you have non-Mendelian. Okay, so that's one requirement of Mendelian genetics. Exactly two traits for whatever characteristic is being studied. And the other requirement is that one of those two traits has to completely dominate over the other, which also doesn't always happen. But if it doesn't happen, then it's non-Mendelian. Okay, now, that's the results of one of his eight experiments, but slide 4 shows you all eight experiments conducted exactly the same way as far as crossing them with the pollen. But, like I said, what differs is that he ignored everything except one characteristic in each of these batches of, each of these fields of plants he was growing. We just looked at the flower color one, he ignored everything else, but he did another one for flower position, for seed color, seed shape, and so on. Every one of these has exactly two traits for the possible for the characteristic. So there's not more than two colors in the seed color one and so on. Not only that, in each of them, one completely dominates over the other. So when he did this hundreds and thousands of times, he noticed that it didn't matter what characteristic he studied. If he did the same thing, went to F1 and then bred those to make the F2, in the F2 he always got a ratio of almost exactly 3-1, dominant to recessive. All right? And because of that, he, without knowing anything about DNA or genes, came to the conclusion that there are packets of material, which is we know as chromosomes, being passed on from generation to generation, and because of the numbers, he figured this all out impressively, published his results, which were ignored until after his death, and then discovered by someone else, and now is the father of genetics. Okay, 5 is a picture of two chromosomes. Now, these are chromosomes from the pea plant, the experiment we just looked at, the flower color experiment. And peas have an N greater than 1. So they have other chromosomes, but we are not paying attention to those because in any given genetic experiment, you typically focus your attention on just one characteristic. All right, now, there's only one type of chromosome in a pea plant that has the gene corresponding to flower color. In other words, the flower color gene is on only one of the N types of chromosomes that pea plants have. Why is it that we have two chromosomes here? How would you explain that using biological terminology? It's true that there are two traits in the population, but that's not why we have two chromosomes here. We have these two chromosomes are from the same individual.
One provided from the gamete of each parent?
Right. And in other words, this individual is diploid. Is diploid, right? That's why we have two chromosomes here. Plants, like animals, when they're multicellular, are diploid. Alright? So any given gene has to be found somewhere on a particular chromosome. It's not random. It's always, in every generation, always at the same place, on the same kind of chromosome and in the same position on that chromosome. Remember that a gene, by the way, is just a subset of A's, T's, C's, and G's it's part of the longer overall chromosome, one long DNA stretch. Well, that particular position on a chromosome where you find that particular gene is called that gene's locus, which is really a word that means the same as location. And for flower color, the gene is found on just this kind of chromosome, and specifically at this locus. Now, there's all kinds of other genes here, thousands of other genes, but we don't care about them in this experiment because they control other characteristics. Okay? This is a diploid cell, though. So that means in a diploid cell, there's going to be a gene on one chromosome, and there's going to be a gene on the other homolog, right? The other chromosome of the same type. It's possible for those two genes to be genetically identical, but it's also possible for them not to be. In other words, for any particular gene, there can be multiple versions of the gene. It's considered the same gene, but there can be multiple versions of it. It's the same gene because of what it controls. It's flower color in both cases here that it's controlling. But there can be different versions of it, different DNA sequences. And those different versions of the same gene are called alleles. A diploid cell will therefore have two alleles for whatever gene you're studying, in this case, flower color. Now, that's true no matter how many possible alleles there are in the population, because an individual has exactly two alleles if it's diploid. Okay? But in this case, since it's Mendelian genetics we're talking about, there's only two possible alleles in the entire population. And the two alleles are the purple version and the white version. Okay? Those are two different alleles for the flower color gene. I want you to appreciate a correspondence with something I've already defined earlier today. A gene corresponds to a characteristic. That's why we call it the flower color gene. Flower color is a characteristic, right? An allele corresponds to a trait, a particular trait of that characteristic, which is why we call this allele the purple allele and this allele the white allele. They're the same. They're alleles for the same gene, but they are different alleles because they correspond to different traits. Okay, now if we have, as we've already said, the situation that there's only two possible alleles in the whole population, and a diploid has two alleles because there are two chromosomes, then that means there's only three possible types of organisms when all you care about is this one gene. And that's because any given organism is going to either have one of each, a purple and a white allele, or two whites or two purples. There's no other possibility. So this brings up more definitions. If an individual has two alleles of the same type for the characteristic, then we call that individual a homozygous individual. Or that's the adjective. We can also call that individual a homozygote. But homozygous is the adjective. And homo means same. Zygous refers to the kind of zygote that can be produced if this individual reproduces. The reason that makes sense is because in meiosis, as we've just got done studying, when you produce gametes by meiosis, what you're really doing is choosing one or the other homologue, right? Well, if both of the homologues have the same allele, it doesn't matter which one you choose. That allele is going to be passed on to the zygote. That's why it's called homozygous. An individual with one of each, with two different alleles, in other words, is called a heterozygous individual. Hetero means different, or other. Well, there's really only one way to be heterozygous in this population where there's only two possible alleles, right? It's this. Yes, you could have purple on this top one, white on the bottom, or the other way around, but they're the same thing, really. One of each. But there's two different ways to be homozygous, right? One way is to have two purples. The other way is to have two whites. So we don't use the word homozygous by itself because that's not fully descriptive. It's ambiguous. Instead, we use homozygous along with a word that refers to the type of allele. And the purple allele is called the dominant allele, since purple is dominant over white. The white allele is the recessive allele. Therefore, any given individual, if it's homozygous, is either homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive. If you use that whole phrase, then that tells you exactly what kind of alleles that individual has. On the other hand, since a heterozygous individual can happen only one way, heterozygous as a single word is sufficient. We don't say heterozygous dominant. We say just heterozygous. Okay, now because of complete dominance, what that means is that all it takes is one, at least, dominant allele to make that individual have the dominant trait. And a further implication of that is that the only way with complete dominance that an individual can have the recessive trait is to be homozygous recessive. You have to have both of them be recessive, because if either of them is dominant, then the recessive trait is not going to come through. It's going to be dominated by the dominant trait, by the dominant allele. Okay, let's go on to 6. This is exactly the same flower color experiment we've already looked at, but some more information appears in this slide. And this brings up some more definitions. A pair of definitions, which are genotype and phenotype. Let me start with phenotype, which really is basically the same thing as trait. The phenotype is the particular observable trait that whatever individual you're examining has. Whether it's something that's visual or not. Okay? So because phenotype is trait, really, we express phenotypes with a phrase, a descriptive phrase, like purple flowered, that is a phenotype. White flowered is a phenotype. Genotype, on the other hand, is not a phrase. A genotype is a string of symbols, usually letters, that represent the actual alleles that that person or that individual has. Okay, so let's look at the parents here, purple flowered and white flowered. Underneath the purple flowered one, you have the phrase purple flowers. Well, that is the phenotype. White flowers is the phenotype of the other parent. Below those phrases are sequences of P's, the letter P, not the fruit that these plants bear. Those are genotypes. Uppercase P is a genotype. Lowercase P is a genotype. So let me explain this fact that these are all the letter P. P stands for purple, which is the dominant trait, right? And therefore the dominant allele. But we use P's to indicate white alleles as well. We don't use W's. The reason for that is that using a P always reminds you of which of the two traits is dominant. And then we use uppercase to indicate the actual allele is the dominant version, and lowercase to indicate the recessive version. So white allele is lowercase p. Purple allele is uppercase P. Why is it that these parents have genotypes that are two letters long? Because they are diploid individuals, exactly. Each of them has two alleles for flower color. But these are true breeding individuals, like I said earlier. Another phrase for true breeding is homozygous. The purple flowered parent is homozygous dominant, and the white flowered parent is homozygous recessive. You can see that just by looking at the genotypes. Upper P means both of the alleles are the purple version. Lower P, both alleles are the recessive version. Okay, those are the parents. They haven't reproduced with each other yet. They haven't been crossed. But each parent individually is capable of making its own gametes, which you need before the cross occurs, right? One has to make sperm, one has to make egg. Well, that involves meiosis in diploid individuals, just like us. And meiosis, like I was saying earlier, randomly chooses one chromosome or the other. Well, if you have a homozygous individual, which you do for both of these parents, it doesn't matter which chromosome you choose, you're going to get the same allele for flower color since they're homozygous individuals. You can choose the uppercase P or the other uppercase P, right? So this purple-flowered parent can make only one kind of gamete when all you care about is flower color. And notice that the genotype for the gamete is just a single letter because gametes are haploid. Okay? This white-flowered individual can make only gametes that are lowercase p, a single p because it's a haploid gamete also. So egg and sperm get together to form a zygote. That's the beginning of the F1 generation, right? And since these parents can produce only one kind of gamete when all you care about is flower color, that means when you get them together, there's only one possible genotype, one possible kind of zygote they can produce. An uppercase P, a lowercase P. What's the word that describes upper-lower P? Heterozygous, exactly. In other words, this particular cross has to yield nothing but offspring that are heterozygous. And because purple is completely dominant over white, that means every one of these heterozygous individuals is going to be purple flowered, fully purple. Exactly what Mendel observed, right? Now you take one of these F1s and another F1 and cross them. Well, these are heterozygous, so when meiosis randomly chooses one of the chromosomes, it does matter, right? It can choose the uppercase P or the lowercase P. And the same thing for the other F1 that you're crossing it with. This is why Punnett a dead Englishman devised what is called the Punnett Square in his honor. That's what we have down here, the Punnett Square. Punnett is spelled like that. A Punnett Square is really just a shorthand device, but the Punnett Square actually represents real things. Now, in a Punnett Square, above the square and to one side of the squares, you have a listing of gametes. And this is an exhaustive listing, meaning that these are the only possibilities for whatever parents you're talking about. In this Punnett Square, the cross we're doing is uppercase P. We would describe the cross just with genotypes. Upper, lower P, X for cross, with another upper, lower P. And as I was just saying, this parent, upper, lower P, when it comes time for meiosis to produce gametes, can produce only two kinds of gametes for flower color. Uppercase P or lowercase P. So you put one of each down there for the eggs. The other parent is the male. Same thing with the sperm. These are the only kinds of gametes it can produce. So this is an exhaustive listing. Then you have the square itself, which has, in this case, four boxes. What do the boxes themselves represent? If these are gametes, go ahead. Well, what do we don't call them outcomes usually, though. What is the biological word for what's created when these things match up with it? Zygotes, exactly. Fertilization creates zygotes. Punnett Square is a shorthand device representing the process of fertilization for two specific parents. An exhaustive listing of both parents' gametes are shown above or to the side of the square. And then you just match up one gamete from above with one gamete from the other parent on the side to fill in the box. And the box itself is a zygote, right? A zygote is created by a sperm and an egg getting together. Well, the genotypes of the zygotes you get simply by combining the genotypes of the gametes. The gametes have haploid genotypes, just one P. Each zygote is going to have two P's. Now, this Punnett Square does not at all say that these two parents are going to have four offspring. There's four boxes because these two parents can each produce two gamete types, and therefore there's overall four possible types of zygotes. Whether they have one offspring or a million, these are the four possibilities. No other possibility. Okay? Now, think about complete dominance, which I said means, in this case, for purple being dominant over white, it takes only one dominant allele to make that zygote, and therefore that plant, once it grows up, purple-flowered. Well, these three each have at least one uppercase P. So they're all going to be equally purple. The only way to be white-flowered is if you get a lowercase p from each of the parents. That's this possibility only. And so you can see here, when in the shorthand device that we call the Punnett Square, exactly why Mendel observed the 3-to-1 ratio in each of his experiments. It's because there's three ways to be dominant, one way to be recessive. And since it's the phenotype, which is the trait that we're describing here, that ratio is called a phenotypic ratio. Three dominant to one recessive. If you have 1,000 offspring, then you would expect 750 of them to be purple, three quarters of them, and 250 of them, one quarter, to be white. That's almost exactly what Mendel got, because he did it about 1,000 times. Okay, seven. I just talked about the phenotypic ratio. That's what's shown on the left here. This is typical for a Mendelian cross. And I should tell you yet another definition. The kind of cross that we just examined, which was the flower color one, that's an example of what we call a monohybrid cross. Let's break this apart. The hybrid part of this word refers to mixture. That's what a hybrid is, basically. If we have a hybrid cross, and not all crosses are hybrid crosses, but in a hybrid cross, that means the parents differ from each other in their traits or their phenotypes, just like they did for the flower color one, right? One was purple parent, one was a white parent. Mono, meaning one, refers to the fact that in that hybrid cross, all you care about, the only thing you're tracking, is one characteristic, flower color in this case. Okay? So that's a monohybrid cross. And if you have a monohybrid cross for Mendelian genetics, which means you have to have exactly two possible traits and one has to completely dominate over the other, then in the F2 generation, you'll have this familiar repeating 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. But corresponding to that is what we call a genotypic ratio, a ratio of genotypes. And you can see this if you look back to the Punnett square, but the Punnett square just has these same genotypes in it. Notice that there's two different ways to have the dominant trait. You can be a dominant traited individual by being heterozygous or by being homozygous dominant. Well, let's actually quickly go back to the Punnett square. There's only one way to be homozygous dominant. You have to get an uppercase P from both parents. So that's one way to become purple. But there's two ways to be heterozygous. You can get a dominant trait from the mother and a recessive trait from the father, or a dominant trait from the father and a recessive trait from the mother. That's why you have two of the four squares being heterozygous here. It's the same genotype, uppercase P, lowercase p. It's just obtained two different ways with respect to the parents. But that means genotypically these are different, these heterozygous, from the homozygous individuals. These heterozygous individuals are not true breeding. They have the ability to pass on a white allele to their offspring. This true breeder, homozygous individual, does not. So we keep track, even though they are phenotypically the same, all purple-flowered individuals, we keep track of the ones that are different genotypically in the genotypic ratio. And so it involves three numbers, not just two. It's a 1-to-2-to-1 ratio. One homozygous dominant to two heterozygous to one homozygous recessive in the whole batch of offspring, however big it is. For 1,000 individuals, you'd expect 250 of them to be homozygous dominant, 250 of them to be homozygous recessive, and 500 of them to be heterozygous. All right, now to eight. In eight, we're looking at a special kind of cross. I just defined monohybrid. This is a different thing. This is called a test cross. And a test cross is used, or this kind of test cross, is used to determine what the genotype is for an individual with the dominant phenotype. All right, so in that last slide, I was just talking about the fact that there's two ways that you can have the dominant phenotype, right? But you can be homozygous or heterozygous. Well, for flower color, purple flowers, you can easily tell what the phenotype is just by looking at it, right? But you can't at all tell by looking at the purple flowers whether that individual is homozygous, dominant, or heterozygous. And that can be valuable information, like if you want to make sure they're true breeders. Well, the test cross gives you a way to do that without actually getting in there and looking at the DNA. Also notice that if you have a white-flowered individual, a recessive trait, then not only do you know the phenotype, which is the white flowers, but just by looking at it, you also know its genotype without looking at its DNA, because there's only one way to become white-flowered, right? A white-flowered individual, you know its genotype is homozygous recessive, lower P. Is that all clear? Okay, now, there are two Punnett squares here shown, and Punnett squares are predictions. Like I was talking about before with using 1,000, you would predict so many to be such and such. So each individual Punnett square shows you a prediction of what the offspring would be if those two parents were crossed. There's only one cross here, but there's two possible Punnett squares, because what you're trying to figure out is whether this purple-flowered individual is upper P, homozygous dominant, or upper-lower P, heterozygous. You can't tell that right now, and that's why you're doing this cross. Well, you know it's one or the other, upper P or upper-lower P. Otherwise, it would be a white-flowered individual. So one of these two Punnett squares must be true. Each one corresponds to one or the other alternative genotypes. So notice that upper P would give you this Punnett square. By the way, in the cross, what you do is cross the individual whose genotype is not known with an individual that is recessive. Okay, so the sperm are from the white flower. Those are lowercase p. If this purple-flowered one is upper P, then the eggs are only possible upper. We could actually do this in just one tiny square, because this is really just one possibility, but there's two shown. Notice, though, that this predicts only one type of zygote, heterozygous. On the other hand, if the purple-flowered one is upper-lower P, then there's two different kinds of eggs that could be produced, and the Punnett square would predict half of the offspring would be purple, the other half would be white. You following this? Okay, those are the predictions. Then you just go ahead with the cross and see which Punnett square the real results match. Well, as long as you get any whites at all, you know that this one must be true, because this one says white is impossible. And this is also why you would have to have multiple offspring, because if you only had one offspring and you get purple, it doesn't definitely say that this is true, right? You could have gotten lucky. So a large number of offspring makes it even more robust. But this is why you do this, to test whether or not a dominant trait individual is homozygous. Slide 9. Up to now, we've been talking just about a monohybrid cross, other than that test cross, which I just got done telling you is a situation in which all you care about is one particular characteristic. Well, here we have... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong slide in my head. This is a slide also featuring two Punnett squares, but once again, it's two possibilities. The possibilities being tested here, though, the two hypotheses, are dependent assortment versus independent assortment. And we've already been through the fact that independent assortment is, and you already know that that's really what happens, right? So that's a spoiler. But what dependent assortment would be if it did occur, what that would mean is that how one tetrad lines up, red up or blue up, would also determine how all the other ones line up. So they would all line up red up and blue down, or they would all line up blue up and red down. That would be dependent assortment. Well, if you do this cross, which is a dihybrid cross, then you can test whether it's dependent or independent. First of all, a dihybrid cross, di meaning two, is one in which you pay attention to two different characteristics at the same time. But it's still a hybrid cross because the parents differ in their traits. In this case, they differ in their traits for both of the characteristics. Now look at the parents here. What are the two characteristics? Right. Seed color is one characteristic. And seed shape is another independent characteristic. These correspond to totally separate genes, maybe even on separate chromosomes, right? But we're paying attention to both of them at once. That's why it's a dihybrid cross. It's not necessarily that they have anything to do with each other. We're just paying attention to them both. Okay, also, just like for the monohybrid cross, this is Mendelian, meaning that for each characteristic, there's exactly two possibilities, not more than that. So there's two colors here possible, yellow and green, and there's two textures for the other characteristic, or two shapes, which is smooth and wrinkled. Also, for it to be Mendelian, that means for each of those characteristics, one of the traits has to completely dominate over the other. In this case, yellow completely dominates over green. It's the dominant trait. And round completely dominates over wrinkled. Otherwise, everything is exactly the same as a monohybrid cross. You just pay attention to two different characteristics. Now, before I get to that, notice the genotypes for these parents. It's four characters long, four symbols, four letters long. But that's because you're paying attention to two characteristics. For each characteristic, there's two letters. Two Y's, which, like I said before, for the letter itself is the initial of the dominant trait. Yellow is dominant, so you use Y's in both cases, either for yellow or green. But uppercase Y's mean yellow, lowercase Y's mean green. R stands for round, which is dominant over wrinkled, lowercase r for wrinkled. And so these genotypes are four letters long simply because we have to have two letters for a diploid parent for each of the two characteristics, because there's two alleles for each characteristic, for each gene. All right. Well, these are not only true breeding, they are doubly true breeding, right? You have a true breeding, or you have a homozygous dominant individual for both color and texture. It's doubly homozygous dominant, right? Yellow and round. And you have a doubly homozygous recessive individual for the other parent, green and wrinkled. Since they're homozygous for both genes, that means when you randomly choose a Y and an R, there's only one way to do it from each parent, right? Each parent can make only one kind of gamete. That's what homozygous refers to. They're going to pass on only one kind of gamete to a zygote. That's what homozygous means. So this one's going to give an uppercase Y, an uppercase R. This one a lower Y, a lower R. Well, when you cross these gametes, and notice YR is a haploid genotype, you get upper Y, upper R crossed with lower Y, lower R. The only possible zygote, therefore, is upper lower Y, upper lower R. A double heterozygous individual. Heterozygous for color and heterozygous for texture. Because of complete dominance, that means when they grow up and produce their own seeds, the only seeds that can be produced are fully yellow, fully round. So once again, just like when you only paid attention to one, the F1 contains only the dominant trait. In this case, it's the dominant trait for both characteristics, though, yellowness and roundness. Now you get to the part where you test assortment. If assortment is actually dependent rather than independent, then what you would predict when you cross an F1 with another F1 to make the F2 is this 3-to-1 ratio you see in the smaller Punnett square. The four possible zygotes here are three yellow and round, one green and wrinkled. Notice that all four of these zygotes, which are the only possibilities if this one's true, are fully like one parent or the other. These three are like this parent, this one is like this parent, and there's no other possibility. On the other hand, if assortment is independent, then there's more mixing and matching possible with the alleles. And this is a bigger Punnett square. There's 16 boxes in it. And what you see is that some of these are like one parent, some of them are like the other parent, but there are some that aren't like either parent. The offspring that are like one parent or the other are called parental types. Self-explanatory. The offspring that aren't like either parent are called recombinant individuals, because the parents' DNA got recombined for the offspring. Well, the hypothesis of independent assortment predicts that there should be recombination possible. Yellow and wrinkled isn't like either parent. The color is like one parent, the texture is like the other parent. Similarly for green and round, right? There's no green and round parent. Therefore, if you go through with this F2 cross, or crossing the F1s to produce an F2, and you look at the real offspring, if you get any recombinance, that tells you assortment actually happens independently, not dependent. And we already knew the answer because I told you that's how assortment happens. This just proves it. Okay? By the way, these are real numbers here, these hundreds, but this is very close to another famous phenotypic ratio. We talked about the 3-to-1. 3-to-1 is the famous Mendelian phenotypic ratio for a monohybrid cross. For a dihybrid cross, it's a four-numbered ratio, 9 to 3 to 3 to 1. Those numbers add up to 16 because there's 16 boxes, 16 possible zygotes. But 9 of those zygotes are doubly dominant, meaning dominant for color and dominant for texture. 3 of them are dominant recessive, dominant for color and recessive for shape. 3 of them are recessive for color and dominant for shape, and only one of them is doubly recessive. Exactly the way you see it in here. So 9 to 3 to 3 to 1, you would get that if you did two totally different characteristics, but assuming Mendelian genetics. Well, 10 just shows you that these Punnett squares can really, they really can be symbolized by coin flips, because it is truly random. Remember that when I talked about the three sources of variation, genetic variation that sex brings, that third one is random fertilization, which means you just randomly choose a gamete from one parent and randomly choose another gamete from the other parent to get together to form a zygote. So, if there are two possible gametes for a parent, that's like a coin flip. You're going to choose the heads or the tails for the sperm, and similarly a heads or a tails for the egg. Well, if you have a fair coin, the probability of getting a head is 1/2, the probability for a tail, 1/2. And therefore, to get the zygotes, to get an upper R here, you would have to flip a head for the egg and flip a head for the sperm. The overall probability of that is the mathematical product of the individual probability. So 1/2 times 1/2 is 1/4. Similarly for all the others. They add up to 1 because 1 means 100%, all of the probabilities. Right? So it's just a probabilistic way of looking at it. Well, 11 is a transition in the chapter because we've just finished Mendelian genetics. Now we're going to look at some exceptions to that, which are collectively called non-Mendelian genetics. So just let me repeat what the requirements for it to be Mendelian are. You have to have exactly 2 alleles for whatever characteristic you're studying, and one of those alleles has to completely dominate over the other. Well, when those assumptions are violated, then you have non-Mendelian genetics. And that means the ratios that you get in your results are different. It's not really that the genes are working any differently. It's just that the inheritance patterns are different. This first exception that we see in 11 is called incomplete dominance. And that phrase by itself should tell you that this is an exception to Mendelian genetics, right? Because I just got done telling you that one of the requirements for Mendelian is that you have to have complete dominance. Well, incomplete is not complete. It's still dominance, though. So this is also using plants, but a different species. How many characteristics do we have here?
Just one.
We have one. What is the characteristic? Flower color again. Okay, how many traits?
3. 2.
Well, there are 2 traits. There are 2 alleles possible in the population. There's a red allele and there's a white allele. So that seems to be the same. What's different here, though, is that even though the red allele is dominant over the white allele, it's not completely dominant. And you know that because if it were complete, all you would need is 1 red allele to make the flower completely red, right? Just like the purple flowered peas. Well, if you have only 1 red allele plus a white allele for your other allele, then you're only partially red, which is pink. All right? And therefore, you have 3 traits possible, but only 2 alleles still. And you can see in the Punnett square that in the F1, first of all, before we get to the Punnett square, every one of the F1s are going to be pink. That shouldn't surprise you because these are true breeding red and true breeding white. So there's only 1 possible allele for each. They use a different symbol standard here. It's C stands for coloration gene, and then with a subscript is either R or W for red and white. But one can make a red, can give a red gamete, the other one can give a white gamete. That's the only possibility. Therefore, every zygote is going to be red-white, which is pink. When you cross an F1 with another F1, you get this Punnett square. The parents can give you either a red or a white gamete. So you match them up. 1/4 of the offspring should be red, 1/4 should be white, and 2/4 or 1/2 should be pink. I just want to explain this in terms of what genes do, which we've already studied. A gene is indirectly an instructions for how to make a protein, right? The proteins directly give the organism its traits, like I've said many times. Like the coloration here involves a particular protein. Well, for the purple-colored one for pea plants, 1 gene, just on one of the 2 chromosomes, the purple allele, going through the process of transcription and then translation, produces enough purpleness for it to be fully purple. But not so in this case, for this species. You produce a certain amount of redness if all you're using is one red gene, right? And that'll give you a pink result. But in a true breeding one, you have two copies that are both red. And so you're going to make twice as much red protein that allows it to be fully red. Does that make sense? But anyway, this is not Mendelian because we don't have complete dominance. And this particular exception is called incomplete dominance. All right, I'll finish later.